It's the shamelessness, I think, of a lot of the big proponents of Me Too in relation to the Biden question are really, really shocking. The fact that so quickly they're so willing to make these kinds of arguments, you know, whether it's Nancy Pelosi or anyone else talking about how Joe Biden, you know, deserves due process where Brett Kavanaugh didn't, I think can't, you know, you can't help but conclude that they just always saw this as a partisan weapon to begin with.
All right, I'm joined today by Tom Slater. Tom is a well-known journalist and commentator and is the deputy editor of the online magazine Spiked. He's had articles published in The Spectator, The Telegraph, Time Out, and a bunch of other publications as well. He's also a regular commentator on TV and on the radio. He's the editor of Unsafe Space, The Crisis of Free Speech on Campus, and he also hosts the Spiked podcast, The Last Orders podcast. So, yeah, he's a very busy man. To begin with, why don't you just let people know a bit about Spiked and kind of what Spiked is and how you got involved with that and so on.
So Spiked were an online magazine, a radical political magazine, very committed to particular principles that we feel like have been missing in public debate for a very long time, particularly issues around freedom, freedom of speech being a key one for us, and also the issue of democracy, which is one of the reasons why we were very vocal supporters of Brexit and have been defending it ever since. And yeah, we publish every day, range of, as you say, articles, podcasts, and anyone interested in that kind of slightly more distant pro-freedom, pro-democracy viewpoints worth looking into.
Okay. So when was it that you kind of got involved with Spiked at the beginning?
So I have been writing for Spiked for quite a long time. I joined the team in 2013, originally writing about culture, but got more and more involved in writing about politics. And I spent most of my time there working as deputy editor, running the magazine, also running a lot of particular projects that we do around freedom of speech. We used to run university rankings for freedom of speech for a number of years. We toured campuses on this issue, both in the UK and the US. That was a particular focus of mine as well.
Okay. And so just before we look into the free speech kind of side of things, which is, yeah, like, there's quite a lot to talk about on that side of, side of things. But just in terms of Spiked's kind of ideological outlook, if you could try and summarize where you are on the political spectrum, because it's hard to figure out from someone who's not familiar with this kind of area of debate.
No, definitely. So Spiked very much comes out of a left-wing tradition, just one that has almost completely evaporated. As I say, in terms of the principles that I was just talking about, those are incredibly unimportant to the modern day left. If anything, they're incredibly agitated by them. So we've always been a bit of an outlier in that respect. I mean, so much so that these days, you know, we've oftentimes, even though we kind of position many of our arguments in that kind of left-wing history, we also want to draw out the radical case for the principles that we are advocating for. We're often just kind of lazy, labeled a right-wing libertarian purely because we're seen to promote those principles, if you see what I mean. I mean, in some ways, I think those, the left and right, have become so kind of confused that in some ways it's not necessarily worth, you know, Spiked's time to constantly plead as to why we belong to that particular tradition and not the other. I think it's, you know, it's the principles and it's the big divides that are at play today, which I think are the most important things about what side you stand on freedom or democracy or anything else. But we definitely come out of that tradition, whether or not the rest of the left has certainly moved on beyond
some of those points. Okay, so moving on to the free speech side of things, I mean, you ran the tour of the US and I think a bunch of other places around the UK as well. So that's the Unsafe Space Tour. And you also wrote a book about the crisis of free speech on campus. And it's something which Spiked covers regularly. So, I mean, you're obviously quite well versed in this whole area. What is it about, what is it that you see as the crisis of free speech, if you see what I mean, at the moment in the UK and in the West?
Well, it's difficult because it has a very long history. And I think that's one thing which the contemporary debate doesn't necessarily always pay attention to. People treat the issue of campus censorship is if it flared up basically over the course of the past 5, 6, 7 years, whereas it's got a very, very long history. There's always been elements within student politics and certainly within university bureaucracies trying to crush speech. That's really nothing new. But I think the thing that's really probably brought it to bear at the moment is, on the one hand, you have an incredible kind of intolerance, you know, in society in general. You know, there is a growing consensus, the idea that speech is effectively violence. You know, you see that enforced via things like hate speech laws. You see that underpinning a lot of the arguments for censorship on campus today. And I think the other thing that's really brought it to to the fore is the rise of this identity politics, which I'm sure you've talked a lot about on this show, and it's something that Spike talks a lot about, given the fact that for whatever reason, it is the most intolerant form of politics about today. You know, kind of regardless of the arguments that it makes, the end point of it is always that certain voices have to be snuffed out because the existence of certain views, which is an increasingly broad category, actually pose mortal threat almost to certain groups and certain people in society. So I think the kind of coming together of those two things, a kind of long-running intolerance, but this kind of identity politics, this incredibly, you know, kind of this idea that individuals, particularly from certain groups, are victims, not just of circumstance, but of words, I think has supercharged a lot of those trends that we've been seeing, you know, for far longer than the last 5 or 6 years.
So do you think this stuff started in the ivory towers and then has disseminated into wider liberal mainstream culture? Or do you think it's something which has just kind of emerged with in line with social media becoming more prominent in public debate? What do you think gave rise to the situation where things have seemed, or at least from my perspective, it seems like things in the last sort of decade or slightly more than the last decade have become increasingly censorious? And it's hard to exactly pinpoint what it is that's given rise to that shift? Or do you think that that's just a tendency which has always existed and you've only started to focus on it now? What's your view on the whole background of it?
Well, it's difficult because, as you say, it's a kind of chicken and egg question. You know, is it something that it came from the academy, that there was a body of ideas articulated, which is certainly true. You know, there's trends in academic thought which have really led to this idea that speech is violence, you know, whether it's kind of critical race theory, a lot of postmodern thought, a lot of kind of the cultural studies left, which emerged in Britain in particular, you know, in the post-war period. You have a lot of these strains which have kind of contributed to it. But at the same time, I think it's also quite clear that, particularly in Britain, you know, on the basis of law, we've had hate speech laws in this country for a very long time. And if you get into an argument with quite a kind of censorious student, they cite these things. They say, you know, there is speech that should be, that is a, as a matter of law, is snuffed out because it's deemed to be too racially or in terms of inciting religious hatred, too harmful. Therefore, why can't we say that someone who believes that, you know, there is such a thing as biological sex also don't fit into that category? So there's definitely a kind of a relationship between the two. And I think the thing that's probably one of the big things that's changed, particularly in recent years, is the extent to which the academy, which as we is kind of founded on the idea of freedom of speech, it's supposed to be a place in society that, if anything, is set aside more for free discussion and more for open debate, almost more than anywhere else, has started to capitulate to this stuff a lot more. Yeah. I think that's a key aspect which is really not often accepted, which is that really these students who have been saying that so-and-so needs to be no platform because they're a hateful bigot and they pose a threat, they're often just kind of cowed to. Their arguments are often not really taken up. There's been an incredible kind of cowardice in meeting those kinds of arguments. And I think the most extreme examples you see that, are, you know, things like in the US, the kind of Evergreen State University.
Wait, can give a background of what happened. That's absolutely mad. So just give like a bit of a background on that.
No, definitely. And this is kind of like one of the most extreme examples of what I'm talking about, right? So you've got Evergreen State University. It's a very, very liberal university. And there is a professor there called Brett Weinstein who took issue with a protest that was happening on campus, which was this idea of a day of absence, something that they'd been doing at the campus for a very long time, in which the ethnic minority students and faculty would leave campus to demonstrate the contribution that they otherwise made. One year they decided to flip it on its head and basically ask the white people to stay away for a day. And this professor, despite his, you know, immaculately left-wing credentials, said that he took issue with this. There's a big difference between, you know, absenting yourself and then asking people to stay away. And he was hounded for this. You know, people students basically chased him off campus. And I think the most fascinating bit of it is that the head of the university just completely kind of gave in to them. You know, I think he ended up hiring one of the people who were involved in the protest. There's amazing footage of him, you know, basically trying to make his case, being shouted down, constantly apologizing for himself. And I think that, in a really extreme example, the point in which you basically had these mobs running around campus completely undeterred, is a kind of really extreme example of what I'm talking about.
No, but I'm not even sure if it is that extreme. Like, have you seen the footage of them in the canoe? You know, there's a canoe meeting. That's so funny. That's literally like something out of South Park. Like, I couldn't believe it. It was literally just members of staff getting on stage, including lecturers and PhD students and so on, getting on stage and just basically prostrating themselves in front of a mob of furious people. And just some of them were crying and stuff and just saying things like, I am a white supremacist, I am a white supremacist, even though they unbelievably blatantly are not a white supremacist. There's so many issues with that, which I want to dig into. So, for example, did you see that? I think it was the dean. I'm not sure what the right term is, mm-hmm. but the guy who's basically in charge of disciplining either the students or Brett Weinstein and his kind of dissenting mm-hmm. colleagues was accused of being a white supremacist, despite being one of the most liberal people on the planet, pretty much. And mm-hmm. his response to that was like, oh, I don't think I'm a white supremacist, but maybe I actually am. Like, it's so South Park. And I think so. One of the points I want to talk about with you is that I, like you and you guys at Spike, share a lot of the concerns about people like that with that mm-hmm. worldview restricting our ability to discuss certain issues or being in control of the Overton window, i.e. the window of acceptable thought and discussion. I think those people are a very small minority, but are very, very influential and have been able to shift things quite a lot. So one of my major concerns is that when it comes to free speech, those people deciding what is the really far right speech, which we should not be allowed to hear, for example, mm-hmm. I don't trust their judgment at all. But where I think I have a slight parting of ways with you guys, but I'm not sure, like, it'd be interesting to discuss it, is on the commitment, on the kind of free speech absolutism side of mm-hmm. things. I know that you guys at Spike, correct me if I'm wrong, tend to think of yourselves as free speech absolutists. So what you primarily care about is just the principle of free speech itself mm-hmm. being defended almost in a First Amendment type way in America, mm-hmm. Which I definitely understand and have sympathy with. But I can see the argument for if there's a far right figure or very, very far right figure, a fascist or an Islamist extremist, for example, who wants to speak on campus, mm-hmm. I can see why you could listen to the argument that those people speaking in public might encourage more people to go along with what they're saying and spread their ideas. Mm-hmm. So I'm not as driven to protect the right of an Islamist or a jihadist or a fascist to speak as I guess Spike would be as free speech absolutist, because my main concern is that the people who are in charge of defining what far right is at the moment don't have mm-hmm. a very good judgment. So is that something which you would tend to take issue with? Would you be like, no, we just defend it as a matter of principle? Is the principle above all?
Well, it definitely is the principle above all. And I think because it comes down to that question of who decides, and what you were talking about there is kind of the perfect illustration, because when people think about censoring speech, sometimes they don't think about it as censoring speech, but the kind of speech restrictions a lot of people are comfortable with, even people who, you know, generally get the principle, are, as you say, the most extreme, the most bigoted, you know, things. We know it when we see it, really. You know, as you say, if it's an Islamist or if it's a fascist or whatever. I think the problem is that the point still stands that one person's hate speech is another person's deeply held moral belief. And if the standard by which, if it effectively some kind of loose idea of bigotry or extremism becomes the means through which we categorize what is beyond the pale, it is going to expand, or at the very least, as soon as someone gets in a position where they can impose their own standards, they're going to fill that with their own particular preferences. You know, it's going to be people like Julie Bindle or Jermaine Greer who by these kind of student protesters are seen in the same bracket, you know, as a Nick Griffin or someone from Hizb ut-Tahrir or whatever. You know, that's kind of the issue with it, is that if you don't kind of defend it across the board, it is inevitably a kind of subjective standard. And that's really important to stick up on a point of principle, just for the sake of saying that no idea should be silenced. But there's also a really important kind of tactical point here as well, which I think the left is entirely deaf to. You know, it's a historical fact that, you know, Weimar Germany had laws prohibiting libeling the Jews, etc. This wasn't something which stopped Nazism in its tracks. You know, if anything, various prominent members of the Nazi Party used these convictions as a kind of propaganda exercise to demonstrate how, you know, the authorities were trying to clamp down on them. And the problem with censorship is that it has a tendency to lend a glamour to ideas that really don't deserve it, to kind of burnish the narrative of an Islamist or a fascist who wants to pose themselves as an enemy of the state, as an enemy of mainstream society, as someone who's trying to say something that they won't let you hear. So even on there's the principal point, but there's also the tactical point. It just doesn't strike me as particularly smart to either hand the weapon of censorship to some authority who might not always be aligned with your views or, you know, in your control. And on the other hand, to basically just lend so much more glamour, so much more of a platform, in a sense, to people by shutting them up, because it tends to just make them and their supporters think that maybe they actually do have a point.
I have a great deal of sympathy with the argument mm-hmm. that you have to allow everyone the right to say what they truly believe. And also that by banning that, you're not getting rid of the ideas. You're just basically pushing them underground where they might flourish. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I mean, thinking back to, for example, so something which you often hear free speech absolutists arguing, and I personally am very, very close to that position. I just always have these reservations in my mind. So you'll hear them arguing good ideas basically rise to the top and bad ideas mm-hmm. get kind of taken, like they just lose their validity once they're exposed in public. You often hear that argument. But then if you think about like vast ways of the world at the moment, there are ideas which we would very, very strongly disagree with, for example, mm-hmm. to do with like the treatment of women and so on, which are mm-hmm. in the predominance. Or if you look at, just to take the most ridiculous extreme example ever, fascism in the 30s, mm-hmm. those ideas were given airtime, and it's not like everyone was like, ah, oh, what a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. Like they obviously did eventually catch on and become very popular. So mm-hmm. what is it which gives you the kind of confidence that that would happen if you, especially in the age of social media, if you mm-hmm. just expose people repeatedly to these ideas, is your just basically you've got a trust in humans' innate rationality and their ability to have group wisdom when it comes to an issue like that?
No, definitely. I think we do have to have a lot more faith in individuals. And I think, not that I'm saying this is what you're arguing, but yeah. I think a lot of the kind of, but you know, the motor behind a lot of censorship is a lack of faith in people and their ability to sort truth from fiction, to work out, oh, just to be good people. You know, that's a kind yeah. of assumption. When people talk about silencing Tommy Robinson, whoever it is, they're not really as bothered with him as they're worried that some idiot might hear him and instantly be won over to it. That's really what's at the heart of their minds when, you know, that's really what's at the heart of their thinking when they're going about this kind of stuff. So you do have to believe, I think, in ordinary people and their capacity to be convinced and for their minds to be changed, even if they hold some of these views or potentially open some of these views. I think we've still got to uphold that. I think the other thing is that a lot of the really nasty views which exist in, you know, across the world today, you know, some of these do not exist in perfectly liberal societies, shall we say. These are not places, yeah. if you're talking about, you know, misogyny in Iran, where it's particularly straightforward to make a case for women's rights. We know this is not the case. So there's obviously, you know, it's important to recognise, I think, when you do have a properly kind of free debate, there is so much more room for those arguments to be made. Yeah. And the other thing is that, you know, ultimately, it doesn't matter if we feel like there's a tendency which exists, which is really quite dangerous. There's all kinds of ideas I think are dangerous and unpleasant and upsetting and having a bad impact on society. But if you want to get rid of them, then you do have to challenge them. You know, in no way possible does actually just snuffing them out mean that whatever portion of the population might actually be into that will just stop thinking it instantly. That will still be a source of tension. That will still be a source of potential threats. Yeah. And so it's just, you have to kind of rise to the challenge of it. It's not always easy. You don't always win. And often the people who are right and do have right on their side sometimes don't win. But I think it's just far more preferable and also far more effective in bringing about the kind of society that we might want than resorting to these tactics, which I think tend to only ever make the situation worse.
Yeah, and also on that point, one of the reasons I was keen to kind of draw the distinction between the debate about free speech in the abstract, which I think is a really interesting one, which I have a lot of sympathy with your point on, and the debate about the existing way in which it's used, i.e. it tends to be one very vocal section of kind of activist leftists who use this argument about no platforming people, is that at the moment, even if you put the debate about free speech as a principle to one side and just look at what's going on now, to someone who's not very well versed in this whole discussion, it might sound like we're having this really kind of pernickety debate where it's like, oh, but it would be better if that fascist was able to go speak on campus. And it gets quite depressing to constantly be making that point. But actually, that's not the point which many of these people are making. What I personally find so annoying about this is that the people who are in control of using that narrative, so they'll constantly put themselves on the side of fighting a fascist coming and speaking on campus, which is a very difficult thing to argue against, are just defining people, in many cases, unbelievably hypocritically or even completely inaccurately as very radical or very dangerous and not applying it to other people. And it's such a messy area. So just to give one of about a million different examples, when you mentioned the example of women's rights in Iran. So Marian Amasi, you know, you probably know Marian Amasi. She's like a secular Iranian activist who came, I think she grew up in Iran. She came to the UK to give a speech in Goldsmiths about why she's against radical Islamism and against the regime in Iran. And then the Feminist Society, the LGBTQ Society, and the Islamic Society all joined together to basically try and no-platform her. So a secular feminist who is arguing the case for women's rights and against theocracy, they no-platformed her and started hurling abuse at her and stuff on stage. When the head of the Islamic Society, I think, had said some of the most homophobic things ever about gay people, the situation in Iran is unbelievably awful for women. It's much more close to what you consider far right and possibly worthy of being banned than Marian Amasi. So it's like, even if you accept that free speech could be limited in the case of the far right or radical Islamist or whatever, I don't think that these people are a good judge of what that is. So you've probably come across like hundreds of different examples of those sort of things on campus, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, completely. And I think that the Marion Namazi example is a really fascinating one. I'm glad you brought it up because, first of all, because of the strange, shall we say, alliance between feminist students, LGBT activists, and from what I can tell, you know, Islamists on campus is a pretty strange one. But I think actually gives a bit of an insight into what we were talking a little bit about earlier, which is the role that identity politics plays in this. Because obviously it's absolutely ridiculous for a Iranian feminist dissident left-winger, you know, she's a full-blown communist, Marion Namazi. The idea that she's some kind of like hate-filled bigot just because she has obviously left the Islamic faith and, you know, campaigns against it, particularly in its relation to treatment of women, is some kind of threat is ludicrous. But it only really makes sense when you look at that kind of the kind of Western identity politics, which wants to kind of basically just kind of stack all of these different grievances on top of each other and work out where things sit in the hierarchy. So the potential that Marion Namazi saying that Islam isn't very good for women is potentially going to upset Islamic students for some reason comes higher than her, you know, making her own points and speaking from her own experience, you know. And it's that which I think we really need to grapple with, because on the one hand, you can't create a kind of hierarchy of who isn't allowed to speak on campus because it doesn't really work. But on the other hand, it's so completely detached from reality, because if you're talking about, you know, the fate of women in Iran or anywhere else in various theocracies around the world, these are people who are genuinely oppressed, who genuinely need, you know, voice given for them, who genuinely need to have more of a place in our discussion. Yet because of the kind of almost arbitrary way that kind of identity politics and intersectionalism kind of operates, they're completely sidelined. So I think that's one of the things that, again, has kind of really complicated the picture, which is because they have this kind of preordained hierarchy, this kind of preordained narrative that they have to glean to. They end up going after people who, you know, broadly speaking, they should be on the same side of, but because of this, they're not, for some bizarre reason.
Yeah. And also on the kind of opposing Islamophobia point, so I would actually say that, I mean, there's a huge debate to be had about the nature of the term Islamophobia, like what Majid Nawaz says about it's better to use the term anti-Muslim bigotry. But definitely, I think that it's worth being concerned about anti-Muslim bigotry in the West. But it's much more complicated than that anyway, because loads of what's going on in Iran, for example, it's not like what's going on in Iran benefits all Muslims. Like, it's such a basic picture being painted in black and white terms of how to deal with these situations. Mm-hmm. And it's treated like you'll get these people. So another example of that is, I think there was the Christian Union somewhere was banned from giving out leaflets in the Freshers' Fair at Edinburgh or something, because it's a microaggression to have the Christian Union in the Freshers' Fair. So I'm like, I'm a massive atheist. Mm-hmm. So from my perspective, it makes absolutely no sense that you would ban the Christian Union, because even the Christian Union being present is considered a microaggression. And you would also ban someone who's criticizing religion, because her being present is microaggression. It's impossible to marry those two things up unless you just get into this whole power structure hierarchy dynamic, which it's basically just like pseudo intellectual, in my opinion. And it just, there's no way of rationally marrying all of those different things up. Another example is with like some of the Corbynista movement were the most vocal in terms of no platforming and trying to silence the far right, trying to silence extremists. But, and so if you get, there'd be guilt by association is what they'd love to do. So I saw on Twitter, I don't want to name names, but Yasmin Mohammed is someone who grew up, she was forcibly married to an Al-Qaeda husband and managed to escape. And a left winger spoke out in support of her. And then the Corbynistas started piling on that left winger because she had associated with Yasmin Mohammed, and Yasmin Mohammed had been critical of like the faith she grew up in or whatever. It's like, so that's, that guilt by association exists there. Mm-hmm. And then you look at something like Corbyn hanging out with members of Hamas who say in their charter, if you see a Jew behind the tree, go stab the Jew to death. And they're like, ah, whatever. No worries. Like, it's, there's literally no logic to it at all. That's, I think, from even kind of an apolitical perspective, it just it doesn't make any sense.
No, it's completely balmy. I think the other thing that I would say on the question of Islamophobia in particular is so many of these people who are at the forefront of, you know, saying that, you know, we must silence, you know, speech that either criticizes Islam or could be seen to be some sort of affront to the Muslim community. I think we really need to push the point. On the one hand, a lot of the time, they don't really understand this community that they're trying to speak on behalf of. Islam is a very diverse religion. There's all sorts of different views within it. There's all sorts of different members of that community. This treatment of them as kind of this monolithic, intolerant thing that has to be tiptoed around, I think is incredibly, you know, demeaning in many respects and really doesn't speak to the full picture. And the other thing about it is that there's no more mainstream Islamophobic perspective that I can think of than the idea that this one group in society, this one particular religion, needs to be force-fielded from a fence, needs to be force-fielded from, you know, everyday debate, because they're kind of not like the rest of us. You know, they'll get more upset, they might fly off the handle. These are kind of the implications of what it is that they're saying. And that, as far as I'm concerned, because again, the issue of whether we want to call it Islamophobia or anti-Muslim bigotry or whatever, it's a core problem that, of course, we do need to tackle. But tackling it should be premised on the one hand, treating these people like adults, and on the other hand, not kind of expanding the term so much to the point where we're just talking about, you know, a far more kind of nebulous idea of Islamophobia rather than what it should be, which is straightforward bigotry, which we know when we see it. So I think that it's just worth pushing that argument that, in terms of the most mainstream Islamophobic perspective I can think today, it's definitely those people who effectively see Muslims as kind of like children to be looked after rather than other citizens in this society who should be involved in the cut and thrust of debate as much as anyone else.
Yeah, well, I definitely agree with the point about homogenizing entire groups and speaking on behalf of them. That's definitely what that section of the left tends to do quite often, which I find very disconcerting, because it also just does it very selectively.
Yeah.
As in, so if the Jewish community comes out and says, I'm against Corbyn hanging out with Hamas, which obviously there's no such thing as a Jewish community, but if that happens, a lot of them will be like, oh no, those people don't represent the Jewish community. So it's like
they're all Boris Johnson supporters or whatever.
Yeah, so there's so many double standards. But then again, I do think that I do worry about just saying that, oh yeah, obviously it is patronizing to talk about the Muslim community in that way. But at the same time, there is obviously bigotry on the right, which I guess rationally a lot of Muslims would be quite worried about, just kind of unrelated to this culture wars thing, which I guess is always just worth pointing out. But that, I guess so. you can just take that as a given, really.
And I think just on that, I think it's also quite important that because the thing about the far right, the hard right, is that they have really exploited the mess that we've gotten into on this particular issue. You know, because if you get into a situation in which any criticism of Islam is deemed Islamophobia, despite the fact that, you know, like yourself, I'm an atheist, I should reserve the right to criticize religion. I didn't think it was that controversial thing to do up until a few years ago, you know, no matter what faith it is. If you get into that perspective, then you give them a lot more room to operate. You know, they can just kind of say that, look, they're not going to let you say anything about this religion. They kind of, some of them pose quite explicitly as kind of almost new atheists in some respects, nowadays in particular, some of these kind of far-right agitators. And similarly, you know, if you think about some of the issues in the UK, say around the grooming gang scandal or whatever, in relation to a certain portion of largely Pakistani Muslim men who have been, time and time again, there's been gangs of them discovered who have been committing the most atrocious crimes. The refusal to talk about that, which reports have shown into Rochdale and everywhere else, that it was bred at least a failure to both actually investigate it, but then later also to report, to actually discuss it, was bred of a fear of kind of, you know, what discussing this might mean, will it unleash Islamophobia, has again given these bad actors a lot more room to operate, to suggest, to homogenize, to say this is what Muslims are like. So that the our inability to have a kind of clear-eyed discussion about this issue and to try and force field it has, if anything, been a gift to those people. And I think it's worth kind of just pointing that out from time to time.
Yeah. I mean, there's also that issue. That is just another example of how this kind of woke politics. So another thing I want to talk about, so I guess we can get into it now. So that kind of comes into the woke politics side of things and the free speech. All of that has, all of those different perspectives have validity, some of the points which they're making. So for example, woke, there's this kind of anti-woke movement. I totally understand the impulse behind that. And I totally understand what people find oppressive about being told exactly what to think all the time. But on the, in terms of the way in which you would talk about individuals from different communities, or you would talk to an individual, basically on a micro interaction level between people, I actually have some sympathy with the woke point. So I really don't like when people just throw all of it out, like the baby out with the bathwater, and it's like, oh, if only we could go back to the days and we could say, you know, all whatever we want. And actually there's obviously a degree of, I just never feel very comfortable when you go into a pub and someone's making a slightly iffy joke. So I kind of tried to distance myself from that. But I guess the thing about the woke situation is, in terms of its political application, it's all very well to be unbelievably obsessed with microaggressions and saying that it's a microaggression to have the Christian Union on campus. And then you take that stuff really, really seriously. Whilst at the same time, there are massive grooming gangs where, like, the systematic rape and abuse of kids across the country is going on, and those people don't bat an eyelid about it, and basically just try to shut down anyone who raises concerns about it as a racist. And I think that that disjuncture
is something which is putting so many people off.
I think the thing that's worth remembering about kind of woke politics, as we might call it, is on the one hand, it has these remarkable blind spots that we talk about, you know, in relation to the degree of scandal. You know, the anti-Semitism one being the most remarkable to me, you know, you had the most woke people in Britain, you know, pretty happily voting for a leader of the Labour Party who most charitably, you could say, has fraternised a lot with people from deeply anti-Semitic organisations and a deeply anti-Semitic view. Is really quite strange. But I think the other thing that's part of that, which is worth talking about, is that also woke politics, which is one of the things that makes it quite hard to challenge, certainly, you know, with people on the left, is it claims to basically be about anti-racism. And I don't think it is. I think it's about something a little bit different. I think it's what it's trying to really promote is a form of identity politics and a form of kind of a kind of re-racializing of society, but just what they deem to be along more progressive lines. You know, I thought that was interesting. You mentioned the kind of microaggressions example. It was at the University of California, I forget which campus, but a couple of years ago, their microaggression policy was published and included on it, and you see this from time to time as well, was saying statements like, I do not believe in race and America is a melting pot. And I thought that was a kind of nice little example of how, because this kind of woke set, this kind of identitarian left that exists, are so obsessed with kind of basically kind of often burnishing their own victim credentials in order to feel like they have more of a position in a particular public debate. Because the kind of idea of this kind of hierarchy of oppression is so rigid, they kind of have ended up placing more and more emphasis and importance on racial difference than it did exist previously. You know, there is this, it is genuinely the point now, and you hear a lot of people on the left say this, which kind of appealing to kind of like, you know, Kingian principles around, you know, colorblindness and whatever, is almost seen as like a right-wing dog whistle. That's kind of how they see it at this point, because they've entirely junked that as an ideal. If anything, what they kind of seem more intent on creating is these kind of little bubbles who from time to time might meet, but still are separate and distinct and shouldn't mix too much. And I think that's a really kind of concerning aspect of it, which on the one hand, the woke set have a lot of blind spots where anti-racism are concerned. But I think part of that, or at least part of the picture here, is the fact that in a way, anti-racism is not primarily what they're interested in. It's this grievance politics, which seems to me to only end up racializing society more than overcoming these differences, which was supposed to be the point of it in the first place.
I don't think there's like serious racism on a widespread like basis, as it's always discussed. But I also think that in 10 years' time, we'll look back at some of the things probably which are normal, like acceptable-ish now or 5 years ago. I mean, like, oh yeah, that was a bit dodgy. So I think that some of those woke people have a point and are aware and are quite nuanced in their understanding of things which aren't huge issues at all, but I don't want to just dismiss them as completely meaningless. But those points, which I'd be happy to listen to, I'll get, first of all, there are the massive blind spots you talk about. And also they get so caught up in the political wokeness, which actually often is just completely nonsensical. Mm-hmm. Or it's just an opinion, which they've managed to basically co-opt being woke away from meaning being very sensitive to what might or might not be offensive to some groups. And to mean you must agree with this political woke political agenda. Otherwise, you're basically really racist because you disagree with my critical theory based view of what happened. So to take literally one of about a million examples, when Lawrence Fox said that he didn't think that Meghan Markle was pushed out of the UK by a racist press. So personally, I don't think that the UK, there obviously are not like dickheads who are quite racist towards Meghan Markle on social media and so on, but I don't think the main reason she was unpopular really was her race. I really don't think that that was why. I could be wrong. They've managed to create this narrative where just disagreeing with that interpretation is as bad as being racist. And that is what I think is the really big problem, how they've managed to just mash it all together into one kind of way of thinking. And you just can never dissent in any way or you're just racist.
No, I think the Lawrence Fox example, I think, is actually quite interesting, because if you remember before the Lawrence Fox thing, you know, and people must have seen it, you know, when he went on Question Time, made these explosive comments, it was basically, you know, a story for about a week afterwards, you know, just kind of constant kind of, you know, hand-wringing and discussion and talk about this new woke politics and how nefarious it was and how he was positioning himself as this kind of figurehead of it. The thing that struck me was the last time we probably had a Question Time blow up of that proportion was when about 10 years previously Nick Griffin from the British National Party. That tells you a little bit about where we were kind of then and now. Back then it was the debate, which is kind of the debate we started with, which is about how far do you push freedom of speech, how far do you push, who do you give a platform, do you genuinely give one to someone who in Nick Griffin's case is an unalloyed bigot, fascist and idiot, as it turned out as well, or, you know, should you no platform them effectively. That was where the debate was then, and it was very testy. Now, you almost had a kind of similar level of outrage about someone who just dared to say that maybe Meghan Markle, that whole her, you know, maybe Megxit is not about racism.
Yeah.
And criticizing identity politics. And yet it felt the blow up was almost the same size.
And also, like, 2 days, I think it was literally 2 days after that or something, footage came out from somewhere in the Middle East, I think it was Afghanistan, of a woman being literally stoned to death. And there wasn't a peep on social media. Mm. So it's like, fine, you can disagree with Lawrence Fox, you can think he's really racist, whatever, but if you're really worried about protecting minorities, protecting women's rights, then you should be aware of, or even mentioning, or concerned in some way with the fact that women are getting literally the Handmaid's Tale in real life. All right, we've got limited time, so let's move on to Brexit, which is so something. So you guys at Spiked have been pretty pro Brexit throughout the whole campaign. What is it which made you conclude that you are pro leaving the EU?
Well, I think for us, the issue was always the democratic issue, first and foremost. I think the kind of issues, the economic question, I think is important, obviously, but I think it's a side issue to the fundamental question. Is about Brexit is a question of who rules, you know, is it ordinary people, or is it people who are unaccountable and therefore, you know, don't have to actually align with what it is you as a policy want? That was really the kind of sheer thrust of it, insofar as that the European Union is a kind of unique organisation in many respects in the nominally democratic world, as far as you've got a parliament that has absolutely no power, just a huge bureaucracy, which has the power to initiate legislation and policies, whether it's on borders or state aid or various other rules, which are basically a matter of treaty law, almost impossible to change. You know, certainly just one particular state that might take issue, it's impossible to change course. So that kind of core kind of issue and was something that we always put front and center of that. I think everything else is subordinate to it. And I think personally, you know, seeing this develop over the years, because I think as a lot of people, the EU issue only really kind of came really into the kind of focus of our minds when the referendum was called and, you know, when the actual debate started to gear up. But the first time I started to think about the European Union was again on that kind of democratic question. You know, when you see in 2008, you know, the Irish reject the Lisbon Treaty, which again was this kind of power grab to try and, further empower the Brussels bureaucracy. They're just made to vote again a year later. You think something's not going right here. You see that happen time and time again. Every time a European nation has voted against the European Union, apart from in June 2016, it basically either just gets ignored or passed by. And then Greece happens, obviously, and the sovereign debt crisis and the outcome of that, where you see a nation basically, you know, economically waterboarded for the sake of trying to keep the European Union project on the rails. I think just got to the heart of what not only an anti-democratic institution, it's been an incredibly vicious one. I think that, and the thing that always struck me throughout the campaign and even to now, is how absent the left were in that discussion, you know, partly because there was a small but nevertheless pretty distinct section of the left which still held on to some of the Eurosceptic principles which used to be a lot more popular in kind of decades hence. But what was striking was that even they kind of abandoned the field completely. And I think that really kind of spoke to how important it was that that democratic message was put front and centre, because in the end, that was the main issue. That was one thing the left used to focus on more than anything else, and yet they were completely absent from it, it felt like.
So just on the Greece issue, though, do you not think there's an argument that, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but Greece essentially did behave in a very unreliable way in relation to its own debts?
Well, I think the thing is, and this is one, you know, kind of regardless where you stand on the kind of, you know, particular economic questions in relation to debt and how that was kind of run up, I think one thing that you saw was really interesting around the Greece discussion, where you had a lot of people on the right, a kind of a line of people on the left, to talk about how the treatment of Greece at the hands of the Troika was so utterly insane, because not only it was effectively a policy, the policy of, you know, these bailouts, which came with incredibly punishing austerity, effectively made it less likely that Greece would repay its loans. You know, this is the thing, like less likely that it would actually be able to repay its creditors, because, you know, the depression that was enforced in that country was so severe. And so that, I think, leads you to the conclusion that there was another motivation in this. There was a political motivation. There was this idea that these nations needed to kind of be punished in some sort of way. Also, that even though when, for instance, they elected the Syriza government, a pretty clear sense that to make clear that it doesn't matter who you elect, these are the rules. You know, it doesn't matter if your nation wants to go a different route, wants to try and renegotiate these bailouts, you're not allowed to. And that was a pretty clear distinction from when, you know, Jean-Claude Juncker had this famous statement, elections change nothing in relation to this particular issue. So I think, beyond the kind of, you know, the nitty-gritty of the situation in Greece, I think it was quite clear what that was about. And I think that was something which should have been alarming to anyone. Really.
And so what did you make of the response? Were you surprised by what happened after the referendum? So basically the fact that most of the political establishment in the country tried to stop it being the result being enacted.
Well, I think it was the kind of, it was the severity and explicitness of it, which was quite alarming. Because as you say, you know, this was something that we knew that the European or the pro-EU elites do, you know, they don't accept votes, which, you know, as far as they would see it, go against what should be the natural order of things. Yeah. It was a profound challenge to their entire kind of right to rule, really. And I think you kind of saw how much they kind of scrambled to try and undermine that. But what was kind of interesting was that arguments against democracy are nothing new, and certainly have been present in the recent period, you know, even before Brexit, but they were always kind of euphemistic.
Yeah.
You know, there was always a kind of element of you couldn't really come out and say effectively that people are stupid, allowing them to vote is a terrible idea,
yeah,
because they will just bring about tyranny, Nazi Germany. Like, you assume those were the prejudices motoring it, but few of them really usually had the guts to come out and say it.
Yeah.
Whereas in the wake of the Brexit vote, all of that was just completely explicit.
Yeah.
You know, the David Lammy MP day after the result saying this madness needs to be stopped by Parliament, you know, constant discussion about all of these, given the fact that the vote was, you know, there was a large amount of older people who obviously voted for it, suggestions that we should rehold the referendum at a certain period afterwards because enough of them will have died off, therefore we don't need to worry about it. Just this kind of most gross anti-human, anti-democratic kinds of arguments just kind of sprang back to the fore. But I think the thing that is important to stress about that is those arguments never really went away. You know, we didn't have a kind of perfect democracy before the European Union, and we've still got to fight for one resembling it after we leave, because a lot of those battles hadn't been settled. You know, a lot of those arguments continue to exist in the establishment. It was just Brexit and that big kind of blow to the system that it represented just kind of brought it much more to the fore, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was quite amazing to watch those arguments emerge and then become more and more explicit as time went on.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I did want to talk about though is possibly, like, do you not feel uncomfortable with the kind of nativist or really nationalist and possibly slightly iffy side of some of the Leave debate?
I think the extent of its kind of influence is often kind of overstated, you know, because on the one hand, you know, first of all, you know, Twitter, as we know, is not the world. But there's also, and we see, you know, you see these kind of bottom feeders float up from time to time and say some nasty stuff.
Yeah.
But it's worth remembering, and this is something which is really not talked about at all, which is, now, obviously, the concerns about immigration were important to the Brexit vote. Of course they were. You know, we all know, you look at opinion polls, you know, it's not even a 52-48% issue. It was more like 75-25 in the run-up to Brexit, in the run-up to the kind of Brexit process, whereby people wanted to bring immigration down by some measure, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, on the one hand, I don't think that is in and of itself an illegitimate opinion. I think you can detach an argument about immigration, as much as I would want to and argue for far more liberal policy, from racism full stop, and from nativism and from xenophobia, etc. Those two things can be separated. But what's really interesting, and this is an argument that actually Spikes has been making for a long time, which is that Brexit is kind of the prerequisite for a far more open and honest and potentially liberal argument about immigration, because the issue was taken out of our hands for so long. It became so much more inflamed. You know, it became something that wasn't really talked about. It became something that, in relation to EU migration, at least, wasn't even a policy competence that we had in this country. So we couldn't even have a debate about it, even kind of if we wanted to. And you see in opinion polls since the referendum, views towards immigration has been softening. And I think that's a perfect example of the fact that you can, when I think its importance as an issue, the fact that it used to always come top in terms of voters' preferences in poll after poll after poll, a lot of this was that kind of tendency, I think, was slightly inflamed by the fact it wasn't something that we were able to talk about. And I think actually taking control over your own borders is an important prerequisite of working out how liberal you want to be in terms of opening them. And I think in terms of being able to have that discussion, it's quite an important thing. And just in general, I think the extent to which the idea, you know, the Leave vote was on at least in large proportion motored by xenophobia and bigotry, I just don't think it's brought out by, you know, the kind of social attitude surveys in relation to those questions anyway. You know, you see a real kind of steep decline in those kinds of attitudes. And I think the tendency to kind of focus on that small aspect of the Leave vote, which might have actually held those prejudices, was purely to the kind of anti-democratic ends we've been talking about, rather than actually having an honest discussion about, you know, how much those views might have existed.
I definitely have a lot of sympathy with those points. I mean, I guess so we might slightly differ in the sense that I do have a slight concern about the fringes and some of the underlying current of the Brexit discussion, but I definitely understand that it's possible to be very fed up by the way that those things are used and just weaponized to the end of what they want politically on the Remain side, I guess, which I just find so it's really disconcerting to see it happen, I think. Especially because on something like immigration, it's not necessarily the case that wanting less immigration makes you dislike immigrants. Obviously, that's quite a niche point, but it's actually quite an important one, which I don't think is discussed very often. Because I think most of those attitude surveys show that Britain is basically unbelievably tolerant of people who are immigrants themselves, like my family are historically immigrants. But I don't think that that means that you have to be in favour of just completely open immigration or of basically outsourcing immigration policy to a massive international body. So there's definitely a distinction to be drawn there, which never is. So I want to move quickly on to one. We might have time for two more topics to discuss. So why don't we go on to the US election? Because I guess loads of the issues we've been discussing now are present and key to what's going on there. So what have you made of kind of what's going on in the US in terms of the run-up to the election? What's your thoughts? And I know you discussed it the other week on your podcast, the Spy Podcast.
Well, it's an incredibly complicated picture, I think, at this point, not least because obviously we've got the coronavirus issue, which is completely, you know, upset any kind of expectations we might have had about what might happen in this election. You know, Trump was going into this thinking that he could just ride on his record on the economy, you know, and obviously that's been completely put in the toilet. You've also got Biden, who was, shall we say, a weak candidate to begin with, but continues to kind of almost mentally disintegrate before everyone's eyes as we go through this. He seems to be holding up pretty well in the swing states, as it were. I just can't. I mean, it's one of those elections where I think because of the kind of broader crisis, kind of a lot of the issues that motored some of the tensions of the last election have kind of been slightly dissipated. I think it's going to be a very odd campaign. It's going to be a very odd race. And I think what's striking about it is that it's just so unpredictable. And I think, but whereas previously the unpredictability about it was, you know, this group of voters who were moving away from the Democrats, kind of thinking they were going to take a chance on Trump, with the whole question in this election was, are enough of those people going to move back? Will, you know, Joe Biden, is this kind of more everyman figure, be able to reconnect with them? I think coronavirus has just put the cat entirely amongst the pigeons and just makes you think that who knows where this is really going to land at the end of all this.
Yeah, definitely. And what do you think about the allegations against Biden and also the footage of him with the kids? Because I talk about this basically every podcast. I sound like so
particularly weird. Interesting.
I love that footage. I used to read Christopher Hitchens all the time, and Christopher Hitchens wrote this entire book about Clinton basically just being a massive fraud and a really, really dodgy character, especially the accusations against Clinton about him raping Juanita Broderick, which anyone who hasn't heard about that should look up what the accusations against Clinton to do with Juanita Broderick are. They were very, very, very serious accusations. He was accused of full-on rape of Juanita Broderick, and it wasn't discussed at all by the liberal media or by liberal politicians. I'm actually really on board with the Me Too stuff. I think it's quite really amazing how many high power people there are who just behave like absolute creeps and never get called out for it. And I think it's completely valid for women to be concerned about this stuff, but it's so unbelievably politicized and cynically used, because then you've got no mention of Clinton. You've got Clinton on stage criticizing Trump for being disgusting to women when he's been accused of raping someone, and there's no ramifications for it. And then it comes to Biden. I think, like, didn't Alyssa Milano, whatever her name is, the founders of Me Too, initially come out and say, oh yeah, but it doesn't matter about the accusations against Biden because I kind of support him anyway.
Yeah, no, it's the shamelessness, I think, of a lot of the big proponents of Me Too in relation to the Biden question are really, really shocking. I think it's worth saying that obviously we've all seen those Creepy Joe videos and him like nuzzling people and, you know, making people look slightly uncomfortable. I think it's worth saying that a lot of those have been, you know, in a lot of those instances, people will come out and say, you know, he was a friend, he was comforting me. And I think it's worth making a distinction between that and what Tara Reid is alleging, which is obviously far more serious and is something which is of a different nature, shall we say. And I think what's kind of interesting about this is, on the one hand, of course, Biden deserves a presumption of innocence. But at the same time, what's been so striking is that both Biden himself and many of the people who are now making defenses of them have obviously not extended that right to other people in the past.
Yeah.
You know, in the midst of the Kavanaugh circus, you know, around this Supreme Court justice and his confirmation hearings, who was accused by Christine Blasey Ford and a few other women, although that was seen as the most credible accusation of sexual assault, you had everyone pile in and basically say that this accusation alone should damn him. Biden himself even made a statement saying something to the effect of, if you're going to step out as a woman into the glare of the public eye and make comments like this, we should start from believing that the essence of what she's saying is true. Fast forward to today, did you do this to Tara Reid? Point blank, no. So this is a kind, you know, there's obviously a kind of hypocrisy here. And you're even now seeing kind of Me Too types effectively trying to make the argument that when we said believe all women, which was the big catchphrase before, we didn't really mean it. We meant believe women, which is a slightly different thing. They're kind of trying to kind of split hairs and trying to make it seem that what they're doing is not what they're doing, which is the fact that, unfortunately, and I you know, I try not to be uncharitable with people when I think about their motivations, but the whole kind of believe all women standard, whilst we understand the motivations for it might be good, it's impossible to uphold in a just society. Accusations alone cannot be enough to damn you, either in a courtroom or in the court of public opinion. I think it's just too dangerous. It can set up a really nasty climate in which it's just competing allegations. It's the fact that we've seen US politics descend into that, I think, has been a bit of a warning about that. But at the time, you kind of think maybe they have just kind of bought into this as an ideology. Maybe that's what you have to reckon with. But the fact that so quickly they're so willing to make these kinds of arguments, you know, whether it's Nancy Pelosi or anyone else talking about how Joe Biden, you know, deserves due process where Brett Kavanaugh didn't, I think can't, you know, you can't help but conclude that they just always saw this as a partisan weapon to begin with, you know, and yeah, that's why they've shifted so quickly on it.
Tom, thanks a lot for appearing on E2 Review. It's been great to chat. And yeah, you're definitely welcome back whenever you want. What's your Twitter handle and stuff if you want to plug it?
Oh, great. No, thanks for having me, Max. My Twitter handle is @Tom_Slater_. And Spiked is just @SpikedOnline, all one word.
Awesome. All right, fine. Thanks a lot and speak to you soon.
Great. Cheers, Max. Cool.